Very good. So the last session is the big one. Who are you? Or are you there at all? Here we're going to go to the deepest question of life. This person inside of you who came here today, who goes from life to life, what is it really all about? Who are you? Or are you? What is the teaching of the Buddha about anatta, the key to enlightenment? It's a strange thing when we talk about who we are. Because the more we have a solid sense of self, the bigger ego we have, the more problems we cause in life. You've ever seen people with big egos? There's one sitting next to you right now. A person with a big ego creates lots of problems in this world. And it's those big egos which cause, like, pride. Are you a proud person? Too proud to admit you make mistakes sometimes? So proud? How many people here have never made a mistake? Put your hand up if you've never made a mistake. If you do put your hand up, that's another mistake you made. But proud people never think they make a mistake. Or they try and hide it under the carpet and pretend that nobody noticed. This is a Muslim story. This is about the, I don't know if you've ever heard about this character called Nasruddin. He was a Sufi. He got some wonderful stories about him. And one day he was like a guru and he had disciples, just like monks have disciples. And one day after a meditation retreat or something like that, or a seminar, as a prize, he let his disciples follow him to a fair. And as he was going to the fair, they saw one of these booths where you could fire an arrow at a target, and if you hit the target, you got a prize. So here was this Sufi cleric, like a monk. He went there and said, "I'll have a go." And his disciple said, "Have you ever fired a bow and arrow before in your life?" He said, "No." He said, "Don't do it. You're a religious leader. You make a fool of yourself and everybody will laugh at us." But he said, "I don't care." And so he brought three arrows. And he lined up the first shot. And this one, he lined it up and shot it. And it went about only halfway to the target before it fell in the earth. He was hopeless. And the disciples started to get embarrassed. As the people saw this religious leader start to make a fool of himself. But Nasruddin, he just turned around and said, "That was a shot of a hasty man." And he put his second arrow in the bow. And this time it took more time. He lined up the target and he shot. This time it made the distance. But it went about a mile to the left. Almost hit a spectator. And the people started to giggle. But Nasruddin said, "Now that was a shot of a proud man." And the disciples said, "Leave it now, you're just making an idiot, a fool of yourself." But he said, "No, I've got one arrow left." And this one he lined up and he shot the arrow and it went right in the middle of the bullseye. And he got his prize, it silenced all his critics. The disciples said, "If the first shot was a shot of a hasty man, and the third shot was a shot of a proud man, what was the third shot?" And Nasruddin said, "Oh, that was me." That was a trouble sometimes when people are proud. There was another story from the Thai tradition. Very similar, but this was not a monk. This was one of these very intelligent and clever men who was so smart that he was invited to join the court of one of the Thai kings. But he was so intelligent and he was sometimes so egotistical that other members of the court were so jealous of him. And he was one of the king's favorites, and so all the other people in the court, they met together one day and said, "This guy, he really sort of gets up our noses. We hate this guy, but he's so popular with the king. How can we show him up towards the king?" And they got this plan together. This guy is so proud, he thinks he knows everything. Tomorrow morning, this is our plan. We'll praise him in front of His Majesty. We'll say, this man, he's so smart, he knows everything. And see what he says. And he'll probably say yes. And he said, he probably even knows what we're thinking. And he might say yes. And if he does, even if he does know what we're thinking, we'll lie, because who can prove what you're thinking? And that was their plan. And the following morning, when the court assembled, when the king sat on his throne, one of the ministers started praising this intelligent man. He's so bright, he knows everything. And this man said, yes, I know everything. He probably even knows what we're thinking. Yes, I know what you're all thinking. Okay, what is it? What are we thinking? He'd fallen into the trap. If they thought, said he was thinking about food, he would say no. Whatever they said, they decided they would say no. What are we all thinking? They asked him. And without hesitation, this courtier said, all of you, you're all thinking kind thoughts towards His Majesty. And they all said, yes, we are. You're so clever. Because if they said the opposite, they'd be in big trouble. So sometimes, proud people, they really upset us. And why are people proud? It's because they attach to their idea of who they are. Sometimes, you know, it's very easy if you're a teacher to attach to the idea that you're a teacher. And sometimes you get it wrong. You make a mistake. And if you do make a mistake, it's much better to admit it. I make mistakes sometimes. I remember this one story of one of my monks who made a mistake a long time ago. Because in our monastery, all of the things which are in our monastery all come as donations. From people such as you, who give a ringgit here, a ringgit there. And especially in the early years of my monastery when we were quite poor. And when I was the abbot, I was very insistent that my monks don't waste anything. I kept on reminding them that, you know, our donors, they weren't rich people. Some of them were ordinary people. Sometimes they were out of work, but they would still bring food to feed the monks. So imagine what it was like when one day I was walking in the grounds of my monastery and I saw a hammer which had been left out in the rain and was getting rusty. It must have been out there for over a week. And some careless monk had left it out there. So I called a meeting of the monks. Now you may think I'm a soft monk, and I'm very kind and gentle, but sometimes you've got to be fierce. So I was fierce. I gave this sermon about looking after the gifts which people give you. You never bought that hammer. It's the gift of kind people. If they saw this hammer left out there getting rusty, what would they think? You're spoiling their faith. They think, what's the purpose of giving these things to monks who are so careless they don't even bother to put the tools away after they use them? This is not on. The Buddha would not approve. It's bad karma. You should not do these things. Don't do it again. And who was it? And all the monks, now sometimes when you give a talk, people are lounging this way and lounging that way like you are. But all the monks were sitting absolutely straight. I really hammered them this time. I really gave them a really fire and brimstone sermon. Which one was it? Not one of them confessed. And that, you know, that was the most disappointing of all. I thought that, well, I must admit, I was a bit tough. I did actually really, you know, go a bit over the top with my fierceness. I can be fierce at times. But maybe it was because they were all scared. I was disappointed because at least if you'd done something wrong, you should admit it. But no one would. So I went out of that hall after that talk, really disappointed in the monks under my training. Why can't they just say sorry? I'd have forgiven them. And as I walked out, I understood had an insight, understood why no one would confess. Because I remembered who had left that hammer out. It was me. And I'd forgotten all about it until after I'd scolded all the monks. One of the most embarrassing times of my life as a monk. I don't know why it is. You tell everybody off first and then you remember. If I'd have remembered first, it would be much less embarrassing. So what did I do? I had to go back in there and say, sit down, everybody. I found out who left the hammer out. And as my penance, I tell that story often. I wrote it in my book as well. But the point of that story is that we all make mistakes. And it's the ego stops us admitting that we are at fault. And that ego stops us asking for forgiveness. That ego stops us solving the problem with a simple, I'm sorry. When you say sorry, it's so easy to forgive and move on. If any of you have misbehaved, if you men have had a mistress and broken that third precept, tell your wife. Say sorry. Not disaster. The disaster's already happened when you first had the mistress. This is solving the disaster. And ask her forgiveness. It's a wonderful thing if you ask with real sincerity, especially if your wife has been here all day, and if she can't forgive, I don't know what you've been listening to all day. Now is your best chance after you've been listening to Ajahn Brahm for 2.5 days. And if someone says that, please forgive them if it's really sincere, as long as they're acknowledging, they're forgiving, and they're learning not to do that again, then that's fine. You know, there was an old Somerset Maugham story I remember reading as a young man. It was about these two planters. I think they could have been in Malaysia. It could have been one of those Somerset Maugham stories from Malaysia. You know, some rubber plantation or coconut oil plantation. And there was a man there with his wife, and his best friend was helping him in his plantation. And one day the wife had a tragic accident. And one of the workers came back to tell the husband, I'm sorry, your wife has died. Oh no, sorry, no, it's the other way around, sorry. The husband, the wife, and the best friend. The best friend had the accident. And as soon as the worker came back and told the man, the owner of the plantation, your best friend has suddenly died, his wife fainted. It's a dead giveaway. His wife had been having an affair with his best friend. So she had to confess afterwards. And he wanted to divorce her. But it was an English man who ran the next plantation. They were neighbours. He came to him and said, don't do that. Forgive her. He said, I had a wife. She had an affair with someone else. I divorced her. I never gave her a second chance, even though she pleaded for one. For the rest of my years, I've been so lonely. Forgive. Because if you can forgive, and the other person can live up to that forgiveness, there is a healing. So, don't be so proud, especially you women, thinking, he's preferred someone other than me. A lot of time it's a pride which does things, the ego. How can I tell my friends? How can I live this up? Don't worry what your friends think. It's your feelings and your future are more important. Forgiveness is much easier when you have a small ego. People with big egos find it difficult to forgive. So the more we understand the teaching of Anatta, the easier it is to forgive others and forgive ourselves and have a much happier life. The ego of ourselves worries what other people think of us. I don't know how many of you are concerned about your reputation. Sometimes you've actually been so concerned, instead of asking a question in public, you've written it in private. I say, please, Ajahn Brahm, don't tell anybody. Now I'm going to read them out. No, I won't. I wouldn't do that to you. But what's wrong with actually saying what happened? In the end, you know, that people, this is an old story, that when you're in your 20s as a young person, you are very, very concerned what other people think of you. That's why young girls have to dress up and they have to keep the fashion. And they have a lot of peer pressure, you know, to be fashionable. Young men have to have what's called in the West street cred. They have to know all the modern words. They have to have an iPod in their ear all the time, even though their mother is talking. They have to know, this is young men, what they're supposed to do. And I remember as a young man myself going to dances and parties. This was before I was a monk. And sometimes you see a nice girl there and you want to go and talk to her, but you get nervous. And why was I nervous? Because I was scared what she would think of me. And so you start practicing what you're going to say. And you go up to her and you say the wrong thing. The words would get all jumbled up. Now, you've had that. Remember when, you know, you girls, when a young man came to see you, sometimes you've got to help them along if you like them. And it's the same with the girls as well. And it was only much, much later, you know, that I realized that's not the way to do things. When you're very young, you're so concerned what other people think of you. When you get to your 40s, as the old saying goes, you get what we call self-confidence. Most people in general. When you're in your 40s, you don't care what other people think of you. You just go and do it anyway. You're yourself. You can ask silly questions. Who cares what other people think of me? You get self-confidence. But the best time comes in your 60s. In your 20s, you're concerned what other people think of you. In your 40s, you don't give a care what other people think of you. In your 60s, you finally discover that people weren't thinking about you anyway. Everybody was thinking about themselves. When I used to go up to those girls and wonder, what's she thinking about me? She was always thinking, what's he thinking about me? Everybody was concerned about themselves. So you don't have to worry what people think of you. You just be yourself, whatever that happens to be. When you're not concerned what other people think of you, you don't have to defend your ego and yourself. And who are you anyway? Sometimes people look at me, I'm supposed to be an abbot. What's an abbot supposed to be anyway? That's why I play around sometimes. And I change the roles. Sometimes, now I'm a comedian sometimes. And when I was in Melbourne giving a talk, after the talk, this young man came up to me afterwards and offered me a job. That's right, as a stand-up comic. He was a professional comedian who went on the television in Australia. I don't watch the TV, so I couldn't recognize him, but apparently he was quite well known. He was saying, Ajahn Brahm, your timing is perfect. And your material, where do you get it from? And you've got, you know, like every comedian has to have the peculiarity. You're a monk in your robes. You can make a fortune on TV. I'll get you the opening. You can be a stand-up comic. I was given a job opportunity. But in the end, I decided my day job was much better, so I decided to stick with being a monk. But the point is that sometimes, if you're a speaker, sometimes you've got to be the comedian. Sometimes you've got to be the counselor. Sometimes you've got to be the supervisor and tell your monks off. Sometimes you're the builder. Sometimes you have to be the diplomat, you know, with the queen. You know the difference between a diplomat and a gentleman? I don't know if I should tell this joke. Tell it? I promise I won't get into trouble? Okay. Okay. Here we go. I'm leaving this evening, so it doesn't really matter. So the old joke, difference between a diplomat and a gentleman. If a diplomat says yes, they mean maybe. When they say maybe, they mean no. If they say no, they're not a diplomat. You know that, don't you? Because you know, you upset people. So say maybe. So when people say, when are you going to, you know, say Penang? I say, well, you know, maybe. I'm a diplomat. So that's the difference. A diplomat, when they say yes, they mean maybe. When they say maybe, they mean no. When they say no, they're not a diplomat. A lady, this is the old type of ladies, if they say no, they mean maybe. If they say maybe, they mean yes. If they say yes, they're not a lady. I'll get into trouble for that for sure. How did I get into that one? Anyway, yeah. So who are you anyway? So the point is, sometimes I'm a diplomat, sometimes I'm a worker. The thing is that when you haven't got a fixed idea of who you are, you can be anyone you want to be. Sometimes I'm an idiot and say stupid things. Sometimes I say the wisest thing. You know, sometimes when I give a talk, before I don't even plan the talk, sometimes I say something, I think, wow, that makes a lot of sense. I get inspired by what I say. Where did that one come from? And other times, I say a dumb thing and I get into trouble for it afterwards. But which one is the right Ajahn Brahm? None of them are. It's just you're always changing to suit the circumstances. It's like Ajahn Chah when he first went to the West. We asked him, what's it like in the West? And he said, oh, when you go to England, he said, you know, or the West, you have to smile. He said, if I went to Japan, he said, I'd have to be severe. He said, wherever you go, you have to fit into the cultures of that place. I mean, that's why you can actually change, you can adapt to the different people. Now that's the sign of like a great monk, who you can never pin him down, what he is or who he is, because he was no one at all. He was empty. When you understand the teaching of non-self, when you know there's no one in here, it means there's no fixed entity, which means you're always able to change. I don't know, have you ever done well at school? Were you intelligent? If you thought you were no good, say at maths, you would be no good. And as a school teacher, I was very careful never to think that someone was bad at anything. That was actually creating a self, saying, I can't do this. And I experimented once with one child in my class who came bottom in mathematics the year before. And I was teaching him mathematics that year. Knowing he'd came bottom, I wanted to do an experiment. Was that because he was a self which just couldn't do maths? Or was it something else? So for one whole year, I gave him special attention. During the class, when I was setting the test, the problems, I would go and stand next to him and ask if he understood it, and maybe help him to explain it a bit further. At the end of the class, I'd ask him, was that okay? Can you understand that? I gave him special attention and encouragement. At the end of the year, he came top in math. It surprised me and everybody else, and surprised him the most. I took him from being bottom to the top in one year, just through extra attention. It was unfair on all the other children, I admit that. But nevertheless, it proves an important thing to me. There's no one who can't do maths. There's no one who can't do sport. There's no one who can't do meditation. There's no one who can't do enlightenment. All you need is extra special attention. Some of you need heaps of extra special attention. But it's a wonderful thing. What non-self means is you're malleable, you're plastic, you can do whatever you want. If you have the confidence to do it. So the teaching of non-self is an opportunity. You are not stuck in your past. Doesn't matter what you failed at, it's only failing now. You can still do whatever you like for the future. You are changeable. You're malleable. If you had a self which was solid and imperfect, there's nothing you can do about it. You're stuck with it, but you're not. It's always changing. And as you understand this more and more, it means you don't need to be stuck in the past. It doesn't matter who you think you are. There's no such thing as being intelligent or not intelligent. I can do it, I can't do it. Everything is open. When there's no fixed eye. Now, as you understand this more and more, it leaves every opportunity open for you. There's no door which is closed to you when you have a malleable self. And that's why when you see highly attained monks or nuns, it's amazing just how they can change and do different things. Simply because they've got a plastic self. Malleable, changeable, just like rubber which can be bent and changed into whatever they want it to be. And I saw Ajahn Chah doing that so often. He could be the very, very kind counsellor. Next moment he could be the fierce master. Next moment he could be laying bricks with everybody else and sharing a joke. It's great to see how people can change the less they are there. And always happy because whatever other body said about them, that's not really me. How can you take any criticism? They say, who was stupid? It wasn't me. It wasn't me who left that hammer out there. Just my five khandhas, that's all. Just my body and mind. Blame them, don't blame me. Whenever you understand the teaching of non-self, it gives you a lot of freedom. But the problem is, how can we actually penetrate that teaching and see it for what it truly is? Because we've got so much heavy conditioning, this sense of I, we've even given ourselves a name. Isn't it great to be able to change? I'm thinking of actually changing my name. So when I go to Singapore Airport and go in the toilet, Ajahn Bum, say, no, it's not Ajahn Bum, it's somebody else. Even changing my face, because for many years I suffered from hay fever. And nothing worked. It's actually cured it now. I went on a retreat and it's just almost gone. It's amazing what meditation can do. But for many years I was always struggling with hay fever. You'd be meditating, you'd be so close to enlightenment, and then you'd blow it, literally. And so I was reading in the newspapers that if you've got a bad heart, you could have a heart transplant. If you've got a bad liver, you can have a liver transplant. So I wanted a nose transplant. And I thought, because I come to Malaysia and Singapore very often, why not have a Chinese nose? Wouldn't that be a wonderful symbol of multiculturalism? Or even better, because I was in Australia, maybe a black nose, an Aboriginal nose. So which one would really be me? Now the point is actually to understand just what non-self truly is. There's two parts of the self. This is a serious part of the talk now. There's two parts to this thing you call you. The first part is what I call the doer, the will. Who decided to come here? Who decided to write that words on the piece of paper? Who decided to turn their head? Who decided to look in their bag? Who decided to get off the chair and go to the toilet? What is this thing we call the doer or will? Because that's important for you. Because sometimes you want to do something and it never goes right. A lot of times we practice meditation, we go to school, we go to courses to make sure our will gets more effective so we can achieve more things in life. The first part of the self is the one in charge, the will. The second part of the self is what we call the one who knows, the knower consciousness. The first is the active part of the mind. The second is the passive part, that which knows. Now, when you investigate deeper, what is this will, this choice, this doer? It gets fascinating. Many years ago, I gave the simile of the driverless bus. This is an original Ajahn Brahm simile. You won't hear this anywhere else. If any other monk repeats this, you should demand royalties for Ajahn Brahm. The driverless bus goes like this. Life is like a bus journey. Sometimes on your journey through life, you have a wonderful time. You have a wonderful, lovely family experience, good health, happiness, prosperity. And you want it to last as long as possible. But sometimes it doesn't last as long as it should. Things go wrong. This is like going on the bus journey. And you go through some beautiful scenic countryside of rolling hills and waterfalls and flower-laden glens. And it doesn't last as long as you expect. So you tell the bus driver, slow down, stop. I want to enjoy the beauty which is surrounding me. And too often, when you're having a good time, the bus driver speeds up. The good times don't seem to last as long as they should. Because the will, the driver, does not know its job. And other times your bus journey passes through some very unscenic, ugly, distressing territory. It goes through what we call the toxic waste dumps of life. And you all know what I mean by that. Sometimes you're having a lot of pain, difficulty, distressing experiences in life. Like the bus driver going through the unscenic, ugly places. So you tell the bus driver, speed up, hurry out of here, as you try and tell your will, please find a way to solve this problem, get out of this pain as soon as possible. But very often when life is difficult, the bus driver slows down, even stops. And the terrible suffering times last longer than they should. So what do you do when you have suffering? You come to Ajahn Brahm for counseling or somebody else to see if you can find a way of getting out quicker. Now the trouble is that you have to find that will, that bus driver, before you can teach them how to drive the bus better, how to slow down in the happy times and rush out of the painful times. So you have to find out who's actually in control. Where are they? And to be able to teach the controller, that which drives your life, and teach them a lesson. Teach them how to drive and experience more happiness and less pain. Where do you think that your will resides? It resides deep inside of you. And when we do meditation, we always go inside. Deep, deep, deep into the moment, into the body, into the silence, into the mind. That's why we call this insight meditation. We're seeing inside. You know what the opposite of insight meditation is? Excight meditation. So this is not about excight, which is exciting. This is insight, being still. So you do insight, you see deep within yourself, until you come to the bus driver's seat. You see the source of your will. Who is in charge of you? And that is where, in deep meditation, you get one of those powerful deep insights which changes your whole life. It's not what you expect. Deep in your meditation, you find the bus driver's seat is empty. No one is there. Have you ever heard of emptiness? Sunyata. The bus driver's seat is empty. When you see that, you know what you do next? You go back to your seat on the bus, you sit down, and you stop complaining. Because there's no one to complain to anymore. You shut up and enjoy the ride. When you realize you're not in control, it's like flying on Singapore Airlines, like I'm doing this evening, from Kuala Lumpur back to Perth. I've got many things to do. I'm in a hurry. So sometimes I thought of going up to the cabin and telling the pilot, can you hurry up, please? Sometimes I thought of, you know, can I see Borodpur from the air? Because we pass over it on the aircraft to Perth. Can you make a little detour, please, for me? Now, of course, no pilot would do that. In fact, when you're in an aircraft, you're completely out of control. Oh, so what do you do when you're in an aircraft? You sit in your seat and just enjoy the in-flight service. The in-flight, not the in-flight service. So that's what you do in life. You sit down and enjoy the in-flight service. Now what we mean here is, when you see non-self, you stop complaining. Welcome to life. People live, people die. Husbands are husbands, wives are wives, monks are monks. Why do we complain so much? There's an old statue in a monastery in the south of Thailand. And Ajahn Chah liked it so much, we have a picture of him in England imitating the statue. The statue is this monk, freshly enlightened, with his arms up in the air. And the caption is, joy at last! To know there's no happiness in the world. Joy at last. To know there's no happiness in the world. What a wonderful, deep saying that is. We always think that if we can control it a little bit more, if we can get this self in line so it's wise, then we won't need to suffer anymore. But this was the realization. Joy at last. This can't be done. So you just sit down in your seat and stop complaining. The end of craving. I really love the idea of will in science. And there was these wonderful experiments which I saw in my youth and which I read about in the books even today, in the journals of psychology. Who is it in charge? One of the most meaningful experiments which I saw was as a student. I'd already mentioned that I was an active member of the Psychic Research Society of Cambridge University. Every year we used to get these weirdos coming to give lectures. Every year we'd have this witch come along. He was a real witch. I still remember his name, Trevor Ravenscroft. What a great name for a witch. And he would come up there, and I remember his introduction. We were always a bit concerned about, you know, witches. What are they going to do to us? But the students, you go to anything. And he'd say, yes, I'm a witch. And he'd say, there are two types of witches. Black witches and white witches. The black witches are the dangerous ones. Be very careful. They are evil. The white witches are the good ones. Having said that, he said, now I'm a white witch. And we said, that's good luck. And then he smiled and said, but even black witches lie and say they're white witches. I remember actually the story of this English witch just after the Second World War. And I remember reading her biography. She's a very, very nice lady and so very kind. She was obviously like a white witch. But she went to the United States to give some lectures. You know, she came out, she was a witch, and had the long red hair and everything else. And so she got invited on a lecture tour to the United States. But in those days, before aircraft, she had to go on the boat, on the cruise, not the the passenger ship, you know, from Southampton to New York. And as luck would have it, as fate would have it, she had to share a cabin with this evangelical Christian. Now, this evangelical Christian insisted of doing this religious service every night and doing this praying and singing hymns. Now, when you're sharing a cabin, it's only confined quarters. You've got to be sensitive to each other. So she kept on saying, look, you're making too much noise. Can you tone it down, please? And the Christian said, no, this is my service. I've got to do this. Can you please calm it down? And she just wouldn't. So the witch got out her knives and her instruments, and she did a witch service. And she had the cabin to herself for the rest of the voyage. But anyway, it's not about witches, because every year in this psychic research society, we'd always have a hypnotist come. And this hypnotist, because we were students, everyone would volunteer. I volunteered once, but I'm not a hypnotic subject. You can tell very quickly, you know, who can be hypnotized and who can't. And there was always one student who was a great subject. So they'd hypnotize this poor guy or poor girl. And once in hypnosis, they made them do absolutely stupid things. It was so entertaining. So much fun. We were really mean and nasty in those days. But one of the things which the hypnotist did on this first occasion, he told this young student doing stupid, embarrassing things, he said, after I take you out of hypnosis, I'm going to touch my left earlobe. And when I do, you will stand up and sing the British National Anthem in full voice. When I touch my left ear, you will sing the British National Anthem. But when you come out of hypnosis, you won't remember that. But I will touch my left ear, you will sing that. We always wondered whether that would work. So after finishing making him do embarrassing things, he took him out of hypnosis and sent him to sit down. And for the next about 15 or 20 minutes, he's a great entertainer. Because every now and again he'd move his finger to his ear and then to scratch his nose. He'd have us on the edge of the seats. But finally, he touched his ear. And this little student stood up and started shouting, God save the Queen! And he sang the whole national anthem. And we were just almost weeing ourselves with laughter. But what happened next? When he finished, the hypnotist asked him, why did you do that? And that young man gave a cogent reason. It was quite clear to everybody in that audience that that young man thought he'd freely decided to sing the national anthem out of a moment of patriotism, when we all know he had no choice at all. He was completely brainwashed. What you think is free will, maybe it's not free will after all. When you go to the shops to buy some cornflakes, when you buy a car, when you buy a dress, have you really got free will what you buy? Or is it completely conditioned by the advertisements which you have seen on the television and magazines? You would be surprised on how easy it is to condition you. Sometimes the will which we think is free is actually just a process of conditioning. Not free at all, but just the process of cause and effect. That is the reason why I tell silly jokes. I have got no choice. I was completely brainwashed by my father, who also told silly jokes. I'm so conditioned that it's beyond my will to stop. That's just the way I am. Remember one of his silly jokes he said? He said that one of his best friends was in an accident. And it sometimes happens. You know, he was in a road accident and he had to amputate his leg. But after the operation, they made a mistake, they took off the wrong leg. So they had to wheel him back in. And of course, once he recovered, you know, having had both his legs amputated, he sued the hospital. He took him to court, but he lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. Well, that was one of my father's jokes. Sick. But that's how I was brought up. So, the conditioning we have for our will. Sometimes you understand that actually your will is completely conditioned. It's dependently originated. The sankhara of chetana, of will, is cause. Once you understand that, you understand why you go to Dhamma centers. so you can have your will reconditioned to be kind, to be compassionate, to be generous. I've been brainwashing you for the last two or three days to be kind, to be generous. You know, one of the best ways of conditioning to people to be generous. Did I tell the last time I was here the story of the spider? Okay. I was going to anyway, I've got no choice. This is how I generate donations. You're done for. Once upon a time, there was this poor, thin, hungry, homeless spider. The reason why he was hungry and homeless and so depressed was when he made a web in somebody's house. The woman of the house saw the web just when it was completed and took a broom and destroyed the web and chased the spider out of the room. So the spider chose another house, made another web, and as soon as it was finished, before it had a chance even to catch one fly and have something to eat, the servant saw the web, smashed the web to bits, and the spider had to run for its life out of the house. It chose another house and the same thing happened. House after house after house. And every time he built a web, someone smashed it to bits. And he never had time to eat anything. No one loved him. No one cared for spiders. And he never had anything to eat. And after many, many houses, he gave up. Imagine that was you. You built a house and someone smashed it to bits. Before you even had any lunch, they destroyed your kitchen. And you always had to move from place to place as people chased you out. So by this time, the spider was so thin. It was so hungry and so depressed. It was what I call a suicidal spider. And there he was walking around the streets of PJ. So sorry, so sad that anyone would cry if you could see that spider. He was so thin, so lonely, so rejected. And he was passing a doorway when he saw this big fat spider. This big fat jolly spider enjoying a bit of sunshine on the pavement. And the jolly fat spider said to the thin suicidal spider, "What's wrong with you? Why are you crying?" And the thin spider told the story of his life, never having a home, never having a dinner, never being cared for, never having a rest. And the fat spider said, "Oh, that's such a sad story. Why don't you come and live with me? There's plenty of space where I am. And there's plenty to eat, and people leave you alone." And the thin spider said, "Where can that be? Whenever I live in a place where human beings are, they always destroy your web, chase you out, you never get anything to eat." "Oh," said the fat, jolly spider, "where I live, no one ever disturbs you. No one ever chases you out. It's the most peaceful, quiet, safe place." "Where's that?" said the thin spider. "It's in the donation box of the Buddhist Yoga Fellowship." "No one ever disturbs you there." "So before you leave, make sure you disturb the spiders." And now I've brainwashed you. But it's nice brainwashing. So sometimes it's important, the Buddha said this, to associate with good people, associate with kind people, associate with wise people, because your will gets conditioned by them. you find you too become kind, you become generous, you become happy, simply because you get brainwashed, you get conditioned, and it's a good thing to do. So, associate with kind people. But there's another part of the self as well. It's the knower, that which knows. That too is empty, just a process. Because once, when Ajahn Chah, my teacher, was still alive, this is one of the great stories of Ajahn Chah, when he, because recently, there was one of the Thai monks came up to me and said, "You know, you were with Ajahn Chah for all those 9 years." And he said, "I'm doing a little CD or a book of people's memories of Ajahn Chah. What was the one teaching which you would like to contribute to this book? What's your most memorable teaching from Ajahn Chah?" And this is the one which I gave him. One of the deepest teachings from my master. In the last year of Ajahn Chah's teaching career, just before he became sick, we knew he was getting sick. He complained about dizzy spells. So out of care for our teacher, but also out of care for ourselves, we built him a sauna in our monastery. In the old text, we found out that yes, even in the time of the Buddha, there were saunas in the monasteries. The saunas were not started in Sweden. They came from India. And so we built a sauna, and we invited Ajahn Chah to come over every week, once a week, to have his sauna. But it also meant we could see our teacher once a week. And when he came over, he'd always give us a Dharma talk first, and then we would take him into the sauna and help him. So it was a great arrangement. We could see our teacher once a week. And after he gave a talk 1 week, it was such an inspiring talk. And I was so uplifted. There were many other monks there. I thought, I'll let the other monks go and look after him and do the services, like washing his bathing cloth, maybe massaging his back. Because I just felt I wanted to meditate. So I went to the back of the hall, neglecting my teacher, and went into a very, very deep and joyful meditation. I don't know how long I was meditating there for, but when I came out afterwards, my first thought was, maybe there's still time to serve my teacher. So I got up and started walking towards the sauna. But I was too late. Ajahn Chah had finished, because I met him coming along the path in the opposite direction. He was accompanied by two Thai laymen, his driver and somebody else. He was on his way back to the car to go back to his monastery. As I came up to him, he looked me straight through me, like these powerful masters can do. He was checking me out. He had seen from the smile in my face that I had just emerged from a very deep state of meditation. He decided to try and enlighten me. He looked at me, and he barked, "Bhamawangso," to get my attention. And then he asked the question, "Why?" There was the opportunity for seeing to the depth of all things. It was a fast way to enlightenment, but I was stupid. All I could think of was saying, "I don't know." And Ajahn Chah, like he always did when you were being absolutely dumb, he just laughed his head off. He thought it was so funny. But then he controlled his features again, and he looked straight through me once more. He said, "Bhamawangsa, I will tell you the answer. If anybody asks that question again, why? This is the answer. Do you want to know the answer to the question, why?" He said, "This is the answer." And he said, "My me arai." Shh, that's Thai. The answer to the question why translates as, there is nothing. And then he looked at me again and said, "Do you understand?" And I said, "Yes." And he shook his head, "No, you don't." "Do you understand?" "No, you don't." Now that's one of the best teachings of Anatta which I've learnt. The answer to the question why. Where does this all come from? Who is this in there? What is this know and do, this mind which you take to be you? The answer to the question why. There's nothing. There's no one in there. Once you see that, you are free. When there's a self, there's something which will belong to you. There'll be ownership, craving and attachment. I always noticed when I was a young monk, I'd given up sex, I'd given up girls to become a celibate monk. And then I started eating too much. I'd let go of my attachment to sex, but now I had an attachment to food. Any of you who've done temporary ordinations at Bickfields for a few days, you know what I mean. Food becomes important to you. So I gave up my attachment to food. And sometimes I just put food in my bowl and stir it all together until it was a yucky mess. But then I found I was sleeping too much. I had an attachment to sleep. And throughout my whole life for many years, I realized whatever I attach to something, I put it down. Stop attaching, I pick up something else. It was so hard to let go of attachments. You drop one thing and you grasp something else. You even remember one of the monks in my monastery. No, this was in the monastery in Thailand. He would had his bowl, his one meal of the day, had his food in his bowl, and he'd be looking at it and he'd push it away. And he'd put it towards him. And he'd push it away. And he'd put it towards him. And he'd push it away. And he'd put it towards him. And said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I'm looking at my bowl," and said, "You're attached to your food." So he'd push it away. And then he said, "I'm attached to being a pure monk," so he put it towards him. He said, "I'm attached to my food again," so he put it towards him. "Now I'm attached to letting go," put it. It's so hard to let go of attachments. You finally get rid of one husband, and then you get your second marriage. Sometimes people do that, you know, they say never again. And they do it again. So why is it it's so hard to get rid of attachments? I realized a simile. I said, when you have a hand, you will always pick things up. That's what a hand does. That's the nature of a hand, to grasp. So that's the nature of a self, is to grasp, to attach. That's what a self does. When is a self in there, there will always be attachments, possessions, graspings. So the only way to stop attaching and grasping, the only way to stop picking up my cup or picking up something else, is to cut off my hand. And then I can't pick up anything. The only way to stop attaching and grasping at things in this world is to cut off the thing doing the grasping. The self, yes. You know, I thought that was another original Ajahn Brahm simile. Until one day I was looking at the Sanyutta Nikaya and saw the simile of the hand by the Buddha. That spooked me out no end. Whether that came from a past life or just coincidence, I'd reinvented an original simile of the Buddha, and you just heard it. So the only way to stop attaching and get free is to undermine the illusion of a self. That's tough to do, but that's the only way. I've told you a very deep teaching today. The driverless bus, Ajahn Chah's answer to the question why there's no one in here. You can't understand that just because I spoke it. You can't understand that by thinking about it. But one day, you'll be meditating so deeply, you'll see the source of will and see it disappear. You'll see the source of knowing and see that vanish as well. you'll understand in the heart of all things is that emptiness. There's no one in here. The phantasm, like a rainbow, like the cloud in the sky. You rise high and see it's just mist, nothing solid. When you can see that there's no one in here, then all grasping finishes. Then you can be whoever you are, or no one at all. Then you are free. What people say about you, who are they saying about anyway? Who is Ajahn Brahm? Who is Victor Wee? Who is anybody? Just an illusion with no solid core. Emptiness at last. When there's no one there, only then is there nothing to do. Freedom at last. Do you understand? No, you don't. But nevertheless, it's an opportunity for questions.